And good morning, Kansas City, and welcome to Central Standard Friday. You're listening to The Movie Show, and that's why I'm here. I'm Russ Simmons with Fox 4 and KKFI FM. And we're going to be talking about films that have come out over the last month or so and give you our feedback on that. But we want to hear what you think as well. And coming up, the 85th Annual Academy Awards at the end of this month. We're going to be sharing some of our Oscar predictions, and also we'd like to know what you think. What are your predictions? What are you torn between? What's been nominated that surprised you? And there's a lot of surprises in this year's very screwy Oscar race. So welcome aboard. You can always give us a call at 816-235-2888. We definitely want your feedback, 816-235-2888. Or you can also join in on the conversation through email at centralstandard@kcur.org or tweet us at KCURCST. And on the panel today, I'm joined by...
I'm Eric Moline from scenestealers.com and KCTV5.
And I'm John Tibbetts. I teach film at the University of Kansas.
Welcome aboard, gentlemen. I know that there's been a lot of controversy regarding the Oscars, and so we're going to get into a little bit of that. And I think perhaps the best way for us to start is to chat about a movie that opened back on January 11th that has some nominations and not others. It's Zero Dark Thirty, the incredibly interesting and bizarre film from Catherine Bigelow about the hunt for Osama bin Laden. Who'd like to take the lead on that?
Well, I think... Since we know mostly what it's about, I think we could talk about some of the issues, especially that of the torture scenes shown near the beginning of the film, which are very mild in comparison to, say, Reservoir Dogs. And the controversy is what? That there probably has been torture?
Well, I think there's
how effective it may have been,
right?
You know, in eliciting confessions and information and all of that. I think Bigelow is pretty much maintaining a kind of ambivalence about it all. I mean, it's out there. Yes, it may have. It probably did, but then maybe not as effective as one could be believing. But I find all of that really overdone. I think it's only because of the politics of this thing that we were hearing much about it at all.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. The politics of torture are what each side of the debate, what they've chosen to spotlight, meaning that the people that are for enhanced interrogation techniques or torture are saying that the film draws a conclusion. It says that there was information here at the beginning of the film where a seed came to be something bigger that led to Osama bin Laden being found. The people that are against torture say that that's not true, and they're angry that the film does draw a tiny line there, and they're saying that Bigelow and Mark Bull, the screenwriter, were misled deliberately by certain people in the CIA to think that that was true so that they would put it in their film. That's the really weird part.
But you know what? What's interesting is that the torture part is only a very small piece
right.
of an overall wide puzzle.
Yes.
And the thing that's interesting about this film is how it shows methodically over a long period of time how all the different pieces of the puzzle are put together. Just the fact that they did show a torture scene is causing controversy, but it's only one, as I say, tiny part of it.
As you say, it's the methodical aspect of the chase, and there is a wonderful sequence in which we are in several different cars in the streets, and we are tracking the driver of one car, who may be a courier to Osama bin Laden. He's driving a white what kind of a car is it that they say?
It's like a Jeep, a SUV thing or something?
It's conspicuous in the traffic.
Right.
And so they're tracking this car. It's fascinating to see how they're going from block to block. Where's the car? Oh, now there it is. How close is it? And they're counting down the number of miles, then finally yards, and then feet of where this car is so we can locate it. I mean, that's what a movie can do. Step-by-step, methodical tracking down, and Bigelow is a master of this.
The storytelling is really undeniable in this film, regardless of your politics, and Mark Bull does an incredible job of winnowing down this huge 10-year investigation into a movie that actually makes sense and that is suspenseful, especially since you know the outcome. And then the last 40 minutes where they have the raid on the compound, there's like no music or cinematic.
Thank you for mentioning that.
It's so nice. It's refreshing because a movie that I had problems with earlier earlier in the year that every time I'm on a panel with Russ, I seem to talk about is Argo. And Argo just turns into this big Hollywood movie at the end where all these ridiculous things keep happening. And finally, they're out on the tarmac, you know, chasing down the plane with guns. But in Zero Dark Thirty, they just, I mean, it's almost like Italian neorealism or something. It's just so stark and so suspenseful. And it just shows what a great master of cinema Catherine Bigelow is. And the fact that she wasn't nominated for Best Director because of the politics of this movie is pretty insane.
And it's not just the music that's underplayed or absent, but it's the fact that the guys that are conducting the raid, I'm not saying this is just routine for them, but the whole dramatic aspect of their characters and what they say and what they do is underplayed as well. Yeah. So it keeps you from feeling this is way too ramped up. This is a more sober look at how an operation like this could have been done.
Yeah, I think sober is the right word because this is almost documentary-like in its realism. And I have had some people complain to me that they felt the movie was dull because of that. And it was so slow to finally get to the point, the raid on Osama bin Laden's compound, where it really does take off cinematically and becomes very riveting. The fact that the earlier scenes weren't as action-packed, I think, shows the fact that we, as viewers, have a short attention span, and that's too bad.
Maybe a word about Jessica Chastain. I'm a huge fan of hers. She's very chameleon-like in her roles. But I was kind of wondering maybe what would be the cause of all the shouting about her role here. Well, watch her in that early, hate to bring it up again, torture scene, where she walks in to the room where it's being conducted. She's curious. She's not sure if she wants to be there. She knows she has to be there. All of that is done wordless. Just in her face, her posture, her movements. Now, that's acting. And on account of scenes like that, I think I can understand some of the hoo-ha about her performance.
And she is nominated, as you said. And Mark Boll is nominated, and Catherine Bigelow is not nominated. The film is nominated for Best Picture. And so it brings up the old thing, who directed the movie then? If you believe in the auteur theory, yes, it is the director ultimately is the creative force behind the success of any movie, then it almost should be automatic. But they have 9 nominees for Best Picture on only 5 slots for the Best Director award. And that's, it becomes one of those things where you scratch your head about, I wonder what the Academy is thinking.
Well, and also famously not nominated in that category this year is Ben Affleck.
Yes, and also Tom Hooper for Les Miserables. And, you know, it's like, and Quentin Tarantino for Django Unchained. Those are the guys that got slighted.
I honestly think that because the director's branch specifically votes for the nominees for this category and it's not the entire branch of the 6,000 members of the Academy, I personally think that the directors looked at the films and just said, you know what, everybody's going to vote for these people. They put in Ben Zeitlin and from Beasts of the Southern Wild and Michael Haneke from Amour because those were the movies they were passionate about.
Right. Let's go ahead and give our rating of Zero Dark Thirty on a scale of 1 to 5.
4.5.
4 for me.
I'm going to give it a 5. So we'll say 4.5, which is a pretty darn high rating from this group for Zero Dark Thirty rated R. And before we move on, we do have a caller, Greg from Kansas City, Missouri, wants to chime in about Zero Dark Thirty and maybe specifically about torture. Hi, Greg.
Well, I remember the late Molly Ivins saying, criticizing her fellow liberals for being intolerant. And I'm just amazed at how many people, and I had a big discussion last night with a guy at my bar on Broadway who wouldn't go see the movie because he doesn't believe in enhanced torture techniques and so forth, and was so sort of closed-minded. And as a liberal who doesn't believe in that either, I think it is so sad that we're so self-righteous that we won't go see a really great movie that's a 5. And the role Chastain plays is fabulous. I think she does a great job with it. I think as a woman, every woman should see this movie because the context in which she had to work in the CIA after 9/11 it gives you such an understanding of that in a way that I think is pretty truthful. And I think for people not just if they sort of because of the torture thing is just kind of ignorance, truthfully.
Yeah,
and I love the movie.
You said something very interesting there that this person did not believe in enhanced torture, so didn't see it. As if to say, to not believe in something means it doesn't exist. This is a very dangerous solipsistic kind of thing. Hey, it does exist wherever you may find it, and to say you don't believe in it.
And the film's not an endorsement
odd.
Either.
No, of course not.
Well, that actually begs the question, Greg, I'd appreciate if you'd chime in on this. The way Bigelow depicts the torture, do you think cinematically that this suggests that there's some way that she feels about it or something that she and Mark Bowles the...
No, and I think that's why it's a great directorial performance. She didn't take a statement. I think at the end of the movie, you ask yourself, would we have caught Osama bin Laden without the torture techniques? And I can't answer that question. I don't know, honestly. I think it's quite possible that that led to his capture. Maybe they would have caught him anyway. But the important part is what happened in the context of this woman working in a male-dominated and very secretive and very not patriarchal exactly, but in the context of 9/11, I mean, nobody believed her, and in spite of she was able to enlist the sort of ground troops of people and convince them through her research and diligence and perseverance and just absolute, force of will that she was kind of right about it, and they were wrong that he wasn't some irrelevant guy on dialysis living in a cave in Tora Bora, that he really was still running the show in large part.
But let's not...
I think we knew that, and there's a point in the movie where it talks about, they could have blown him up, but by not blowing him up, they proved to the doubters, and this guy last night in the bar basically thought it was all a lie. I mean, and this is a liberal who's kind of got this conspiratorial theory that it really didn't sort of happen, that he really wasn't killed. He was really in a cave, and that's sad because that's not true.
But let's not forget that Chastain's character is forced to admit at one point that she's not 100% sure.
Right.
There's
she's
a
95.
Slight little wiggle room there that she creates where she's sure, but not necessarily on the basis of evidence.
She also says, because I know you guys don't want to hear me be so certain, because that's not acceptable for me to be that way.
Right.
And they never let her sit at the table. She always had to sit away from the table.
Right. Hey, thanks so much, Greg. Appreciate your call.
Thank you.
You bet. In some ways, I think that the experience of Jessica Chastain's character, having all of the sexism and the challenges that Greg was just talking about reflects Catherine Bigelow's Hollywood experience as well.
She, of course, denies that, but don't we know? Yeah,
that's right.
Of course.
Once again, you're listening to Central Standard Friday here on KCUR, and you, like Greg, can join in on the conversation by giving us a call, 816-235-2888. Send us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org or tweet us at KCURCST. And let's move on to a movie that I think is in no danger of getting any Academy Award nominations. It's called Gangster Squad.
Ooh, yeah. I don't want to spend too much time on this one because I'm a big fan of movies from this era, the 40s and the 50s, especially crime dramas in L.A., Chinatown, L.A. Confidential, spring to mind. Those are some of my favorite films of all time. And Gangster Squad provides the opportunity for Ryan Gosling, Josh Brolin, and Emma Stone, among many talented actors, to play dress-up in this film and pretend like they're in a movie that that follows any of the templates of these kind of detective films. And actually, what they're in is a film by Ruben Fleischer, the guy who did Zombieland, which revels in violence and gore for no particular reason at all other than to be rated R. And then on top of that has zero clever dialogue and plotting that makes absolutely no sense. This movie looked great, and it was a pleasure to watch. I wish I would have had headphones on and I would have been listening to something else. But Gangster Squad is really a failure on all levels and a complete disappointment. Sean Penn, I should also mention, is in it, and he's just hamming it up. But again, no clever dialogue. There's nothing for these people to do in this movie.
Well, when you're doing something that's more of a pastiche than a satire, you see how easily it can emerge just flatter than a pancake.
Yeah.
You've got to do something, pastiche, well-intentioned or not, without anything, especially the dialogue, Eric. You've got it. I mean, more bad films have been saved by some really good dialogue than we can count, but not here.
Yeah, in this case, Sean Penn looked like he stepped off the set of Dick Tracy.
Yeah.
I mean, is he really in the same movie with these other actors? He's a cartoon character.
Yeah.
And indeed, I felt some of the dialogue was really eye-rollingly bad.
Yeah.
I'll give it a 2. What do you think?
I'm going to give it a 1.
1. So
yeah, 1.5.
This movie.
1.5 it is for Gangster Squad, rated R. And, you know, that, incidentally, is a movie that caused a bit of controversy as well because it was supposed to have been released in the fall. But it had a scene where gangsters go in and shoot up a bunch of people in a theater. And, of course, that was very bad timing. So they went back, re-edited the film, took that scene out, and dumped it in January. And just as everyone suspected, it hasn't done very well at the box office. So that's Gangster Squad, rated R. Let's move on to one that I think both of you guys have seen that I'd missed. And once again, Jessica Chastain shows up, and this time it's a horror movie called Mama.
Well, there is no more sure thing to say about horror films than as long as the ghost, the menace, the monster, the creature remains half seen, or even not seen at all, the better it's going to be. And Mama, on that basis, I think scores pretty well. But without revealing too much, the film reveals too much. And the more we see of Mama, or one of the mamas, don't forget Jessica Chastain, in a sense, as a surrogate mama here, the more we see of the ghostly mama, then, you know, the credibility gets, whatever it was in the first place, gets pretty badly broken. But it's stylish. It's well done. The first half of it, at least, is genuinely creepy. The fate of two children in this house, found after years of being neglected, who may have been cared for by a ghostly mama, the fate of these two children powers the rest of the film. And when they come under the tutelage of Jessica Chastain, there seem to be some hopes for some humanity coming to these abused kids. But, you know, we're left with Mama. There is one scene, however, and I'm going to yield to Eric in a second, but there's one scene I really did love where fairly early in the film, we see the two kids in a cutaway set. There's two rooms we see on screen. In one room, we see one of the children. In the other room, we see one of the other children. But the other children is tugging at one end of a blanket. Now, who is at the other end of the blanket? Could it be Mama? And then seconds after that, at the very top of the frame, I think it's a couple of legs that you see floating away at the very top of the frame. It's like, yeah, bring it on. This is good stuff. And there's a dream sequence in it that's very fine, too. But, oh, boy, by the time we get to the end, it lost me.
Yeah, I agree with John completely. Visually, this movie is really great to look at, and it did have a great mood and a spooky kind of a feel to it. I thought Jessica Chastain was really great as this woman who does not want this role. She does not want to be, motherly to these children. And what completely undoes the movie is the typical horror movie plot, which is so bad. At one point, I have to point out one scene really quick, that a psychiatrist character, who is a very small subplot in the film, actually does one of those dumb horror movie things where he goes out in the middle of nowhere for no reason at all.
In the middle of the night.
Right. And all of a sudden, there's narration. And he's saying, well, I had to go out and look into this because I had to do this, and I was hoping that I would find this. And I'm thinking to myself, when they first ran this film, the audience must have been lost at one point. So they hired him to come back in and give this voiceover to explain the plot. And I agree with John, over-explain the plot. More ambiguity would have been better in this movie. So I'm mixed on it. I'd say out of 5, probably a 2.5.
Yeah, and there's several investigations into this abandoned house out in the woods where all the action had been centered. Why are they going there in the middle of the night? Yeah. With flashlights, they're trying to see something? You know, there's such a thing as daytime. That is so strained. They didn't have to yield to all that kind of stuff. But now, Guillermo del Toro was the producer of this. I have not seen the short film upon which this thing derives. Have
seen
you
it.
Guys?
Yeah.
It's way better.
Apparently, it is amazing.
Yeah, it's creepy.
A guy named Andy Muschietti, who on the basis of the style and craft of the film and camera work, may have something to add to this genre. We'll see.
And so
I'm going to give it a 3.
3 and a 2?
2.5.
So that's 2. Okay, well, we'll say 2.5 then for Mama, which is rated PG-13, incidentally, so that I guess it's teen-friendly, right? Yeah.
And Jessica Chastain does give it her all. Mm-hmm. I mean, all credit to her in a film like this. She gives it her best.
And John, while we're at it, why don't you go ahead and tell us quickly about a film that I think you were the only one to caught called Broken City.
Yeah. I rather liked it, but I can certainly see why some have not. It's a political drama. We have Mark Wahlberg as a disgraced former police detective who's now just doing private eye work on his own. his former boss, basically it was his boss, is Russell Crowe, who's now running for mayor. Well, Russell Crowe calls in Mark Wahlberg to investigate the doings of Russell Crowe's wife, who may be having an affair. And since Russell Crowe is running for mayoral office, he doesn't want to have any kind of scandal attending his campaign. So Mark Wahlberg does indeed start trailing Catherine Zeta-Jones, and who could blame him? But all is not what you think. Needless to say, what Catherine Zeta-Jones is up to is not at all what we thought it was. And Mark Wahlberg is over his head. And we go from there. I don't think it's a very satisfying payoff in the film. But, you know, it's well done. I liked Wahlberg in the role. Russell Crowe, he's got to get rid of that haircut. What is that? But he's commendable as a bad guy. But again, at the end, his villainy seems to be pretty thin. Indeed, it's all based on some pretty trite stuff. So the payoff notwithstanding, I thought it was a well-done film. Political intrigue involving a real estate deal is not especially interesting, but I think it's an above-average political thriller, and I'm going to give it a 3.
A 3 for Broken City, rated R, and as long as Russell Crowe's not singing, that's, yeah, that's all the better. We have a caller that wants to chime in about the Oscars, which we're talking about today. Michael from Prairie Village wants to chat about Silver Linings Playbook. Hi, Michael.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You bet.
So, yeah, to go briefly, when I saw the nominations, honestly, I felt that Jennifer Lawrence was probably the most deserving, if probably the only person deserving for nomination for Best Actress, since, in my opinion, she really carried the film and was by far the best person on screen.
You didn't feel that the other actors in that film were on her level?
Yeah, it was very apparent that, like, I'd say the writing was not great at times and the characters not perhaps well-developed as much, especially, say, Robert De Niro's character. That it was by far, she was the best person on screen that really carried it whenever the film really seemed to not know what it was doing. Like, I'll do a brief example. That really odd scene wherever they get into the fight at the Eagles parking lot because of the racial, like, slurs that are used. And so it seems like the film doesn't know what it wants to do. And then she comes into that scene where she just, you know, yells at everybody about the parlay and the betting. That really seems off.
Well,
and really kind of saved the film.
I'll tell you what. Here's what I liked about Robert De Niro in that movie is that his character is, on the surface, a frustrated man who has these financial troubles and he wants to care for his son, but he really doesn't know how. And there's this great scene in the movie where he starts to tear up as he's telling his son how much he wants to connect with him. But we know that underneath the tears, what he's really concerned about is his son going to the football game so that the Eagles can win, and that is when we really realize the full deal, the full sickness that he has, the illness that he has.
And don't forget, he's not going to the football game.
Right,
and that,
right.
He's so wrought up about that.
Yeah, I really think this is a great performance from De Niro. I liked everybody in the movie, but yeah.
Well, I'd like to add to that in that the mania of the Philadelphia Eagles football fans is legendary.
It's true.
And nasty. And so we have some brief scenes at the ballpark involving said mania and hysteria and frenzy and all that. It's really funny and all too real. My problem with the film is I think Bradley Cooper's character he's a bit subverted by the script because it's requiring his character to suffer one of these miraculous Hollywood sea changes. Now he's emotionally damaged. Well, now he's doing really quite well. And it happens almost like overnight. Now, granted, seeing Jennifer Lawrence could probably have something to do with that, but doggone it, it's just too shallow to have a problem brought up and then just swept under the carpet like that.
Yeah, I know, because it seemed a bit cartoonish to me as well, so sorry to kind of spoiler near the end here, but whenever they do the dance competition at the end, I felt it was beyond corny that they get exactly a 5.0. I felt that was
right.
Really just took me out of the whole thing where you have these, you know, they're showing off that these couples that are really professional dancers are getting like 6.8s or something like that, and here they are, this oddball couple that's doing this completely different dance, and gee, what do you know, they get exactly the 5.0 they need to win the parlay.
Hey, thanks so much, Michael. Appreciate your call.
All right. Thanks for
having
me.
We're going to be continuing to talk about the Oscars after the break, as well as catching you up on some of the other films that have opened over the last month or so, right here on Central Standard Friday. Don't go away. And welcome back to Central Standard Friday. I'm Russ Simmons, and I'm joined by my fellow film critics today, John Tibbetts and Eric Moline. We're talking about films that have opened up over the last month or so, as well as our look at some of the strange developments in the Oscar race. The Oscars, the 85th Annual Academy Awards, will be later on this month. And a lot of people are talking about this particular year's race because of some of the weird developments, and we'll be touching on that. But before we jump back in with both feet, I want to give you a few announcements that might be pertinent to our friends who enjoy the movies. First of all, the Tivoli Theater will be presenting the National Theater Live production of the Victorian comedy The Magistrate, starring John Lithgow, which is a high-definition broadcast from the London stage. That's going to be Thursday, February 7th at 7 p.m. and Sunday, February 10th at 1:30 p.m. at the Tivoli Theater. You can find out more information at kcur.org. Also, the Kansas City Public Library's Movies That Matter series continues. This is hosted by our colleague Robert Butler, featuring 20 films essential to cinema literacy. And on Sunday, February 10th at 1:30 p.m., he's showing the 1950 classic All About Eve. And on Sunday, February 24th at 1:30 p.m., the 1964 classic Dr. Strangelove. And the screenings will take place at the Kansas City Public Library's Plaza Branch. That's at 4801 Main Street in Kansas City. And you, again, you can find out more information at kcur.org. And the Free State Film Festival will take place in Lawrence, Kansas, April 27th through the 29th. However, if you're a filmmaker and you'd like to submit your movie, the deadline is March 1st. And if you want to find out how to submit a film for the festival, you can go to kcur.org for more info. And I understand you have an announcement for us too, right, Eric?
Yeah, actually the third annual Kansas City Japanese Film Festival is going to be held on Saturday, February 16th and Sunday, February 17th. This is at the Nelson Atkins Auditorium. They've got five different films, and the focus this year is going to be on the camps, actually. This is the anniversary of Japanese Americans in internment camps during World War II, and they've got some terrific movies, in particular a documentary called The Cats of Mirakitani, which also features Kay Yust, a distinguished professor of art emeritus, Roger Shimomura, among other people, so... and then also, I guess there's some Oscar parties that we should mention.
Sure.
I'm hosting one at the Screenland Armor. This is Sunday, February 24th at 6 p.m. And you can go to scenesdealers.com to pick who you think is going to win and turn in your ballots. There's going to be tons of prizes. And then also at the Screenland Crossroads is another Oscar party. And that one, I believe, is for charity. So.
And as a critic, I feel empowered to weigh in on that. Definitely check out Eric's party. I've seen them before. They actually watch the awards, but there's a lot of fun and shenanigans.
There are shenanigans
that go on as well. Eric is very good at shenanigans.
Okay, and speaking of Oscars, Kansas City, what are your Oscar predictions this year? What are you torn between, and what's been nominated that surprised you, or what has been left off the list that has surprised you? You can join the conversation, 816-235-2888, or send us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. Or again, you can tweet us at KCURCST. Well, let's go ahead and chat about another film that has opened. This one opened back on January 18th, and it's another one that's gotten a lot of praise for its lead performance, Marianne Cotillard in Rust and Bone.
Yeah, Marianne Cotillard was nominated for a Golden Globe, but she was not nominated for the Oscars, if we want to talk about Oscar snubs. She's fantastic in this movie. It's a French film, and she plays, I guess, a whale trainer who, due to an unfortunate accident, has a very swift change in her life take place. And she meets this bare-knuckle boxer who is trying to a single dad trying to care for his kid, who has absolutely zero normal communication skills. And somehow they're able to bond, and she's able to form this relationship with this guy. And this is a very odd relationship film. Mm-hmm. I think that at every turn, when you think it's going to go one way, it goes another. And watching her be able to come out of her shell and learn to live again without any of the traditional Hollywood cliches is actually really refreshing. And she's very good in this movie.
I want our listeners to know that Eric Moline is executing almost balletic moves as he dances around the details of this plot. Good for you. It's well done.
No spoilers.
Yeah. And You know, one of the things that people often say when they see a couple together that seem like they don't belong, how did that possibly happen? Why is this? Well, that's part of what this movie is about. And it seems to me that here's this kickboxer, this bouncer, who is otherwise some kind of emotionally remote. And yet she's attracted to him. They come from different worlds, different classes. Why did this couple get together? And I think it's because he shows her no pity, which is exactly what she needs after her accident. Yep. She needs that to heal. She doesn't need everyone fawning over and helping her. She needs someone like him who will show her no pity.
Well, we had a remotely similar situation in another vastly overlooked film, The Sessions.
That's
when
a good
you think
point.
About it.
Right. Yeah. Well, now, since she did get so much praise but did not get an Oscar nomination, any ideas, Eric, from your perspective, why she got left off the list?
I, in disagreement with one of our earlier callers, I think the Best Actress category is extremely strong this year. Every person in that category, Emmanuel Reaver from Amour, Kevenjine Wallace from Beasts of the Southern Wild, Naomi Watts from The Impossible, and Jennifer Lawrence and Jessica Chastain, who we've already talked about. It's just a very competitive category this year.
And some were left out, like Helen Hunt.
Yep.
Right.
Helen Hunt got supporting.
Support. Why is it
even though
supporting?
She's on screen for 45 minutes?
It's okay. Fascinating sometimes to see how these things pan out. But so let's quickly talk about why there are 9 nominees. In the old days, for many, many years, they kept the nominee list at 5. Yeah. Why are there 9 this year?
Because of The Dark Knight. I mean, if you really want to get down to it, in 2008, The Dark Knight was not nominated for Best Picture. Many people cried foul, and honestly, ABC cried foul because nobody watched the Oscar telecast that year. And so in an effort to make the Oscars more populist, I think they added more movies, and they went with 10 the year afterwards. But since then, they've gone with this weird thing where it's kind of amorphous, and there's a certain criteria. They do the preferential ballot, the Academy does, and the movies that all fit into a category above the other films are the ones that get nominated, and that number could be anywhere between 5 and 10. And for 2 years in a row, it's been 9.
Yeah, it's if you get 5% number one votes, then you will be a nominee. It's my understanding.
And harder to pin down, I suppose, is the inevitable Hollywood maxim that more is better. It's as simple as that, I think. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it rewards passion. I mean, Amour and Beasts of the Southern Wild would not have been nominated for Best Picture unless that many people put them at number one and were very passionate about them. The same thing with Tree of Life last year. I doubt that Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close was very many people's number one, but I think it's interesting. It makes for... an exciting race, I think.
Well, you brought up Beasts of the Southern Wild, which is one of the surprise nominees, for Best Picture. Also, Kevenjine Wallace, as you mentioned, who's going to be the youngest Oscar nominee ever, pitted against the oldest nominee ever,
in the same
Emmanuel
category,
Reva,
yeah.
in Amour. Really interesting in that respect. And somebody wants to chime in on that, so welcome Julie from Kansas City, Missouri, that wants to talk about Kevenjine Wallace. Hi.
Hello.
What did you think about her nomination?
Well, I was just really excited that she was nominated. I think she deserves it. And I heard her on a YouTube or something just recently. And she was only 5 years old when the director spotted her. And she was 6 when she played that role. Of course, now she's 8, but I thought her portrayal in that role was just extraordinary.
She was really interesting, and I was riveted by her the whole time. I thought she's just a very engaging personality. But my question to you is, in the old days, the Oscars would give honorary awards to outstanding juvenile performances and not, you know, go through the paces of putting a child in a same category with adults. What do you think about that? Should they just have handed Kevenjine Wallace an honorary award?
Well, I think that would be well-deserved, and I don't know how she can possibly compete with the actresses that have been doing it for years and years and are really professionals. It seemed as though she hardly had to act in that role, and so I don't know if that would disqualify her.
I think the term honorary kind of could be a kiss of death. There's a marginal quality somehow to that, at least
by
being in the official running. I think there's a little bit more legitimacy conferred there. I don't know. Honoree just kind of tastes sort of obligatory somehow.
I think that people should focus on what's on the screen. And I don't like all the second guessing where people say, oh, the director manipulated her to do this or what else. I'm looking at the emotional truth on the screen. And in this movie, she absolutely delivered one of the top five performances of the year, child actor or otherwise.
And no movie we saw this year had a more overwhelming impact, I think, than Beasts of the Southern Wild. And the father, the actor of the father, I think he's, what, a barber?
Dwight Henry.
This guy is just ferocious on the screen. Very frightening. I mean, this whole movie is probably my second favorite of the whole thing, of the whole year.
Well, it's one of the, I don't see a tremendous number of movies, but it's a movie I'll never forget. And those two actors, the little girl and the father, were both just phenomenal, I thought. And it left a lot of questions, I think, if you really delve into it deeper, about the love that did exist between those two, which was there. And the father certainly had no skills in demonstrating that to the child. And even though she craved it, you know, she never got it until the very end when she, I don't want to give anything away, but when she
spoiler
did,
alert.
Yeah, when she did finally meet her mother in the little cabaret or whatever that was.
You know,
very strange sequence.
Thanks for your feedback on that, and I think your dog agrees with you on all your comments there.
Yeah.
Thanks for your call. And you can join the conversation by calling in at 816-235-2888, and you can join the conversation as Julie did. And let me ask you, did you guys ever think when you saw that movie that it would be an Oscar nominee for Best Picture?
Because it was the summer. And honestly, up until then, there hadn't really been a movie in 5-6 months that actually moved me. And this movie, it really, really affected me. And so I was hoping. There was a lot of buzz about it at the time, and then it didn't have the box office that it deserved. And I was worried that it would be left out, so I was very happy that that the Academy brought it back. And for all their faults and foibles, I think that the Oscars are still a better judge of the actual art of film than the Golden Globes and the SAG Awards and things like that. And so it was nice to see it come back after being ignored by both of those bodies.
And the Critics' Choice kind of skirts around the issue of the juvenile by having a separate category. As
yes.
you know, Eric and I are both voting members of the Broadcast Film Critics Association, and we awarded Kovanjane Wallace a award, but in a separate category, one for kids.
And it was great to see her up there on stage accepting
it. Great.
She's totally genuine, and yeah, great moment.
Now, before we move on, we didn't quite finish up with Rust and Bone, so what would you give it out of 5 stars?
4.
4 stars. I have a tendency to agree with you on this. However, I felt the movie meandered a little too much, and it's one of those films that I wish it had stronger focus. And then there was almost a sentimental cop-out to me also as we neared the finale. But it's a very respectable, very well-acted, and smartly directed movie. So I'm going to give it a 3.5. So say 3.5. For Rust and Bone, which is rated R. I know, John, you particularly wanted to talk about another film. It's the directorial debut of actor Dustin Hoffman. It's a British low-key charmer called Quartet.
Yeah, 74-year-old Dustin Hoffman, his debut. This film will not get a lot of play here in Kansas City on the part of promotions, but definitely go see it. Opera fans will delight in this portrait of a number of elderly, former, or retired musicians, all living in the Beecham Home for Musicians. That's Thomas Beecham, the great British conductor, a real place in England. And members of the musicians' fraternity live there, and we have this amazing cast with Maggie Smith and Tom Courtenay, Billy Colony, and Pauline Collins, and Ronald Harwood play. I mean, this thing has got credentials all over the place. And we see the gatherings of these people, and the question overriding all is, will 4 of them, famous for their performance years before of Verdi's Rigoletto, will they appear at a charity benefit and once again resume the roles of the quartet, the famous quartet in Rigoletto? Standing in the way of this reunion is Maggie Smith, who is the diva of the cast. What a lovely, lovely film. I will not tell you what happens, whether they get together or not, or whether they sing the quartet from Rigoletto. But along the way, we hear plenty of music. We really enjoy these characters. And there's something about this film that's very gallant. I will reveal that in the final credits, you're going to see photographs of many of the cast members in their glory days as real-life, genuine opera and musical stars. And then you see their pictures as they appear today in the film. It's a beautiful gesture. It reaffirms the authenticity of the characters that are in the film. And there are wonderful asides where some of the cast members who authentically are musicians kind of indulge in little digressions where they perform with each other and sing little offhand impromptu performances that steal the show. I give it my highest recommendation, 5 stars, Quartet. Dustin Hoffman.
I like the film as well, but not nearly as much as you did, John.
Well, I'm so thirsty for films that deal with good music, for one thing. I'm biased.
Granted, I'll give you that. I felt the charms of this film, which were there, were extremely low-key charms. And it's,
as charms should be.
And it's slow-moving, sweet, but also soapy. Let's face it, these characters, what's the big conflict? It's the fact that Tom Courtney and Maggie Smith were married decades earlier and divorced, and they still, have the bruises at are affecting whether or not they're going to be together. You know, so it's okay. It's, as I said, it's sweet-natured, but it's not particularly profound. I liked it. I'll give it a 3. So let's average it out to a 4 for Quartet.
But at least we see Tom Courtney delivering a lecture about opera and rap.
That's true. You don't hear that very often.
No, you don't.
That's Quartet, rated PG-13. I think if you like the Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, then this movie's probably right up your alley.
But Maggie Smith in a radically different role.
True.
This woman, I think we tend to caricature her because of Downton Abbey.
Yeah.
We forget that this is a very great actress.
I think this movie proves that although talent may fade with age, egos do not. And that's very evident among these.
Especially musical egos.
That for certain, yeah. For certain. One thing that I've noticed coming up over the next few weeks, quick succession, we have big action stars who made their debuts in the 70s and some earlier, who are having new big-budget action flicks in theaters. The most recent example was Arnold Schwarzenegger's The Last Stand, and that's a movie where he said he'll be back, and by golly, he's up to his word on that. It's really could have been a recruitment film for the National Rifle Association, because this is a film where he has to make one last stand against a Mexican drug lord who's speeding to the border trying to get out of the country in a souped-up Corvette. It's coming through his town. Arnold's the sheriff of this small Texas town. He's got to defend the border. And sure enough, the guy's coming through. So what does he do? He goes and finds one of his fellow citizens in this small town who's a hoarder of ammunition and guns and all this stuff that, semi-automatic weapons, cannons, bazookas. This guy's got it all. And if he didn't have that, we never might have been able to make that last stand against this bad guy.
So being well-armed is the single
being
most
well
important.
Being well-armed is the answer, and that's the answer that The Last Stand wants to give. This movie is profoundly silly. It's the gore and the violence is over the top. So I'm willing to give it 2, and I think maybe that might be a bit of a stretch. But it has its entertainment value for those of you who are willing to put your brain on hold for a while. Another movie is Bullet to the Head, which is also rated R, with Sylvester Stallone. Sylvester Stallone plays a New Orleans hitman who is really this movie has a very high octane action factor. It has a very high octane sleaze factor. Yes. Because it's the old school 80s style action flick directed by Walter Hill, the first film that Walter Hill has done in over a decade, first feature film. He's well known for movies like 48 Hours and Red Dawn, The Warriors. Yeah.
Southern Comfort.
Yes. Yeah. He's made some very, very good films. And unfortunately, this is not one of them because this is an old 80s style with contemporary cynicism and contemporary gore and violence. And it's just sleazy. You know, I just felt like I needed to take a shower after I saw it. So I'm going to give A Bullet to the Head 2 stars out of 5. I think that, you know, it's a nice throwback, but I just wish they could have held down on the excesses. And so I think that's really what ruins it. The third film coming up is Bruce Willis in the latest Die Hard, and we'll be covering that on our next show. And so guess what? I can't wait. All right. Let's move on to talk about another film that opens today. It's a unusual zombie film called Warm Bodies.
Yeah, Warm Bodies is put out by the same company that makes the Twilight movies. This is Summit Entertainment. And I think that it's similarly marketed towards a teenage audience, and it's about forbidden love. In this case, it's kind of a Romeo and Juliet story. The head zombie, his name is R. He forgot the rest of his name. And Teresa Palmer plays Julie. So the symbolism there is not lost. But what's really interesting about this film is that it has a sense of irony and a clever sense of humor that is completely missing from the Twilight movies. The Twilight movies are these overheated soap operas where they take themselves very seriously. Warm Bodies has a sweet love story about Nicholas Holt, this zombie who falls in love with the girl who he eats the brains of her boyfriend and then subsumes his memories and falls in love with her. But this is the only zombie movie with a wry sense of humor and also hope. And you don't get hope in the zombie apocalypse very often.
Does that make it a zombie movie, though?
Well, that's interesting. You could certainly say that it has the trappings of a zombie film, but it doesn't actually deal with any of the themes that in fact, this is just like the Twilight series. It's a metaphor for teen alienation. And I think it's got a great sense of humor. And Jonathan Levine, who directed 50-50, does a really great job of making it a unique film. There's a big pop soundtrack that's a huge part of it. It does lack a little bit of plot movement in the middle. It's a little squishy, but I just like this take. It was refreshing, I visited the set like a year and a half ago and interviewed everybody, and it was a pleasure to see it come to the screen, and I thought they did a good job with it.
So. Do you have photos on your website of you in zombie makeup?
I do, actually, yeah.
So if we wanted to see you as a zombie, where would we go?
Scene-stealers.com and also Lawrence.com. And
you
these
mean
are the
that's
only...
not what he's wearing today?
And these wait are the a minute. Only... He's wearing his Dave Grohl get up today.
Yeah, the only places you'll be able to see that because my scene was cut.
Oh, sorry to hear that. So good. We'll need to see.
Yeah, let's hear it for broadcast television.
You know, this movie doesn't make any bones about the fact that it's Romeo and Juliet in zombie makeup. I mean,
there's even a balcony scene.
There's the character zombie's name is R.
Yeah.
He can't remember the rest of his name, and her name is Julie. So you know, it's like, yeah, okay, I get it.
Yeah.
But you know, I felt that in spite of the fact that it was so derivative, it somehow manages to still be original and clever and touching. And so it's almost, if you'll forgive me, a zombie movie for chicks.
It's there you go. Zombie chick.
Well, it's inevitable, isn't it, though, that a genre born out of a soulless, dehumanized, lurching creature would start to evolve into a more humanized, a soulful story. But what happens as a result is maybe you lose the raw power that animated, so to speak, the zombie genre in the first place. Maybe it's a sacrifice that was needed or inevitable. But purists might kind of wonder, where is this thing going?
Yeah, this is not a movie for purists. Yeah.
And what's your rating on Warm Bodies?
3.
3. I'm going to give it a 4, so we'll say 3.5 for Warm Bodies. Rated PG-13, so it's a teen-friendly zombie movie. There you go. I wanted to quickly talk about the Oscar-nominated Short Film Showcase, which will be at the Tivoli opening today. And, you know, people often say when the Oscars come around, say, well, what do I care? What do I know about? I'll never get a chance to see them. Well, thankfully, the Tivoli and Jerry Harrington, the folks over there, are making these films available for you to see in separate showcases. There's an animated one. There's a live action and the documentary showcase as well. I've managed to see all of the animated entries. I've seen all of the live action entries. Have not seen all the documentary ones quite yet, but I'm hoping to catch up with those. The animated entries are very, very strong this year. They're visually stunning. There's some interesting thematic things. If you're a dog lover, you will love this one film called Adam and Dog about the first time that dog became man's best friend. It's very touching, very sweetly done. I'm going to give the whole overall showcase 4 out of 5.
I might mention in that group that if you made paper airplanes as a kid, you might be happy to know that as an adult, paper airplanes can be used in Wooing the Fair Lady. That's the film, The Paper Man.
Yeah, I thought that was quite good as well. You know, all of the animated films are good, and the short films are from all over the world. You get Afghanistan, you have France, you have Somalia, a really interesting about take on pirating and how that affects individuals. It's quite good, so I'm giving that a 4. Wanted quickly for you to give us a rating on Parker, the action film.
I thought on the strength of Jason Statham's underplayed kind of heroics, I'm going to give it a 2.5. Although nobody takes more beatings, more lethally so, than Statham in this movie, but he rises to the occasion every time.
Thank you so much. Thanks to my fellow movie critics, Eric Moline and John Tibbetts. On Monday, Central Standard will have an in-depth review of the Super Bowl ads, the real reason why we watch, right? Up to Date is next with a conversation with puppeteer Paul Mesner, 90 Mile View, and the Weekend To-Do List. Our show today was produced by Matthew Long Middleton. Our announcer is Kim Noble. I'm Russ Simmons. This is Central Standard Friday. Enjoy your day.